Welcome to the Creative Language Technologies Podcast. I am Roxana Guruju, your creative host, bringing you information on the multifaceted aspects of this emerging field at the intersection of science, technology, engineering, math, and medicine with the broader sector of humanities, social sciences, arts, and culture. The podcast aims to revitalize technological imagination and explore creative themes with social impact. We hope to build a community of creatives by stimulating interest in new modes of collaboration and creation processes that represent diverse disciplinary views and help transform current practices of language technologies. Here is the show. This is episode number 31 of the podcast, and it's Thursday, the 27th of April, 2023. My guest this month is Tony Shimero, a distinguished research professor of philosophy and psychology at the University of Cincinnati and the primary member of both the Center for Cognition, Action, and Perception and the Strange Tools Research Lab. In his research, both philosophical and empirical, he addresses questions related to nonlinear dynamical modeling, ecological psychology, complex systems, phenomenology, and social cognition. He is the author of more than 100 articles and the books Radical Embodied Cognitive Science, 2009, MIT Press, and Phenomenology, second edition, 2021, with Stephen Kaufer. In this episode, I asked Tony to introduce the field of ecological psychology and share his views on its potential importance to and impact on artificial intelligence. Details are provided in the interview notes. Here is the show. Hello, Tony. Welcome to the show. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. So let's start, because we have so many important topics to cover. What is ecological psychology and why should we care about it?
So ecological psychology, as it's practiced now, was basically invented by James and Eleanor Gibson in the 1960s and 70s. And the idea is that in order to make sense of us as perceivers, actors, thinkers, experiencers, we can't start with what's happening inside of us. We have to instead to look at animal environment systems is the phrase that they often use, although it's been expanded lately. Now that people talk about plant cognition to plant environment systems or organism environment systems. Again, the idea is that the object of psychology needs to be bigger than we thought it was before, not just a brain or brain areas, and not even just a brain and a body and an environment.
Mm-hmm. And if I quote Bill Mace correctly, who said, ask not what is in your head, but what your head is in, does ecological psychology look at cognition and behavior differently? Is cognition inside of our brain or is it outside? And to what extent outside? How far outside? Otherwise said, how does ecological psychology depart from traditional intellectual positions?
Right. So, going back to the first scientific revolution in, the 1600s or so, we've had this idea that our minds are radically separate from the environment and only get information into these little special spaces through very low bandwidth connections to the world. Like, your eyes and your skin. And that idea of understanding of the mind over here and the world over here only dimly appearing in the mind basically had been killed by the beginning of the 20th century for a variety of reasons, but it was reinvented by the cognitive revolution of the 1950s. And the cognitive revolution of the 1950s just said, okay, your mind is a set of software that runs on your brain, which is a kind of computer. And like a computer, it has only a few sources of input, so not enough information available to it to make sense of the environment without a lot of innate background assumptions. And that kind of lack of access to the environment is what ecological psychology is primarily calling into question. Also around this time, Noam Chomsky argued against behaviorist theories of language by talking about the poverty of the stimulus. The whole point of ecological psychology is that the stimulus is not at all impoverished. There is, especially if an animal moves or an organism moves, even very slowly like plants do. I'm going to stop talking about plants all the time, I promise. Even very slowly, then it actually generates a whole bunch of information and sufficient information so that there's no question about what's out there in the world around you.
Right, yes. So the revolution of the 1950s, which, as far as I know, has also been called the first generation cognitive science, was an umbrella that covered a number of fields. I think there were six of them or seven. Artificial intelligence was actually the youngest field there. But as you mentioned, linguistics was one of them, cognitive science at the time, and others. There have been probably many shifts in terms of theoretical directions in some of these fields and less in others. In fact, linguistics and artificial intelligence still follow to a great extent the Shannon's theory of information, which has its own limitations. But we're going to get back to this when we cover technology later on. So the replication crisis in psychology has really brought many issues, not only in academia, but in media in general, in recent years, raising major concerns about the field, but also extending to sciences more broadly, and asking researchers to look for and consider stronger methodological rigor. Now, is ecological psychology a science? Can it be defined as a science?
Yeah. Let me say something brief about the replication crisis first. So one of the things that happens, and especially in journals like Psychological Science or Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences, they like splashy, unexpected results, which is to say results that are quite unlikely to actually be true. And the majority of psychology experiments that have failed to replicate are ones that gave us surprising findings, right? So things that we wouldn't have expected given our other theories of how the mind works. So in some respects, I feel like the replication crisis is actually valuable because it makes us not believe the things that are so flashy that they appear in the New York Times on Tuesday as a significant scientific finding, when in fact some of them occur just because of statistical errors. So I think the replication crisis is a crisis, but you know, a crisis isn't necessarily a terrible thing. With that said, maybe 5 years ago, there was a kind of hubbub on Twitter about the replication crisis really affecting the embodied cognitive sciences, of which ecological psychology is one of the kind of inspirations. And in fact, that's not true at all, right? There are a few kind of, again, surprising findings that didn't hold up about the relationship between the body and thinking. But the kind of core ideas of embodied cognitive science, which are drawn from ecological psychology, were not really called into question. Okay, that's my little rant about the replication crisis. You asked if ecological psychology can be a science. Now, when James Gibson published this book, The Ecological Approach to Visual Perception, in 1979, it was a very unusual book. Unlike most books called about perception, and he intended this as a textbook for, you know, teaching perception at universities, it begins with about 8 chapters of philosophy. And basically a description of what the environment is like. And his idea was that you need a theory of what the environment is like before you can have a theory of what it is that we experience and perceive. Again, the book is beautifully written. Also, it's full of things that when you read them, you're like, oh, I understand that. And then you think about it 5 minutes later and realize you didn't understand it because the prose is very clear, but the ideas are difficult. And so Gibson publishes his book in 1979 and promptly dies. And So it was subject to some high profile attacks by Jerry Fodor and Zenon Palitian, among others. And in response to that, some of Gibson's followers, especially Michael Turvey, Bob Shaw, Bill Mace, who you've mentioned, and Ed Reed, published this massive 80-page article in the journal Cognition, where they basically made Gibson's impressionistic and philosophical ideas into concrete, actionable scientific concepts. And I mean, I don't agree with a lot of how they did that. I think it does some damage to what Gibson actually intended, but it certainly has been fruitful for doing scientific psychology. So they gave definitions of information and perception and what it is for perception to be direct that actually enabled Gibson's kind of philosophy, basically philosophy of nature, as sometimes called, to actually lead to rigorous scientific psychology. So ecological psychology has been a science for, four decades now, and a very successful one, tens of millions of dollars of grants and hundreds of publications and thousands of publications, awards, a journal. So, I mean, it is a science, but I've argued against, these people are my friends, Turvey, Shaw, Mace, well, Ed Reed died before I had a chance to meet him, but we argue about this. And I think what they did is they did their understanding or their codification of Gibson's ideas was really valuable for creating a science, but didn't do justice to the kind of philosophical and conceptual complexity of those ideas. So and this is true of science in general, right? In order to make something accessible to an experiment, you have to really, really simplify it. And in effect, that's what they did. They took Gibson's ideas, which were kind of inspired by William James and to a lesser extent, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, and made them into something that were concrete and actionable. But so yes, ecological psychology is a science. It probably wouldn't have been if I were the one who got to Gibson first instead of Turvey and colleagues.
Yes, yes. Well, as you said, the book is actually pleasant to read, but it really needs the reader to sit down and synthesize the information and try to think about the implications of that. Gibson's actually brings up many interesting ideas, one of which being the concept of affordances, one of his major contributions, even though has been talked about a lot, has been poorly understood. What is your interpretation of Gibson's affordances, and how does this concept help us better understand how people view the world in general cognition and behavior?
Well, very simply, affordances are opportunities for action that you can engage in that exist in your environment. That very simple definition, which is easy to make sense of, actually turns out to be very hard to kind of pin down in much detail. The initial kind of interest in the idea of affordances comes in product design, really. So Donald Norman's book, The Psychology of Everyday Things, which was renamed The Design of Everyday Things, because that was a confusing title, basically rides the idea of affordances for 100 pages at least, but gives a definition of it that is at odds with what Gibson intended, right? So Donald Norman makes affordances into not something in the environment, but something mental, right? That is, they are an internal mental representation of something you can do in the environment. And again, that doesn't align with what Gibson intended, because again, Gibson was intending that there's so much information in the environment that we don't need to talk about what's going on in our brains to make sense, at least initially, of how we behave. So the initial excitement about affordances in the early 1980s works with a misunderstood version of it. Again, the idea from Norman and others is that an affordance is basically when you perceive the world, you perceive all the stuff in it, but you also kind of mentally overlay on that what you can do with that stuff. And that's not what Gibson thought. Gibson thought that affordances were things in the world, and our perception of them was what he called direct, which he means not mediated by internal mental representations or computational processes. So that's the first kind of excitement about affordances. was in design, and it was the wrong, it was a grammatically altered version of what Gibson intended. I mentioned Turvey, Shaw, Reed, and Mace earlier. When they wrote that massive paper in Cognition, they defined very rigorously what it is to be an affordance. And from their point of view, an affordance is a dispositional property of the environment. A disposition is like being fragile or something like that. That is, it's a property of the environment that if something happened, something else would happen. Like sugar is soluble. That's a disposition, right? If you put it in water, it would dissolve. But solubility is a feature of the sugar. And so affordances are like that. Things in the environment that if they're paired with the right kind of ability in an organism, lead to some other kind of behavior. So the example that everyone uses is about climbing stairs. So you have stairs in the environment which have the dispositional property to be climbed by the right kind of creature. And you have creatures in the environment who also have dispositions to climb if they come across stairs. But in this case, you know, the affordances are just things in the world, like Gibson intended, not mental representations of the world. They are things in the world. So you asked me how I would define affordances. Now I'm finally getting to that. In response to that work by Turvey and colleagues, I wrote initially a long time ago now, 20 years ago, and I wrote a paper in which I said, hey, wait a minute, this understanding of affordances doesn't do justice to what Gibson was trying to do. Instead, I argued that affordances are not dispositions in the environment, but they are relations between some physical features of the world or cultural features of the world and what a human can do. Now, again, this is inside baseball, right? This is an argument between people who already agree on 99% of stuff. The idea of whether affordances are dispositional things in the environment or whether they are relationships between the skills of creatures and things in the environment seems like it's not that big a deal. But in a recent work with a grad student of mine named Taryn A. Wilkinson, we've realized that understanding affordances as relations has a lot of interesting consequences that you don't get otherwise. For example, if you understand affordances as relationships between what creatures can do and what the world is like, suddenly you don't have to talk about just being able to climb stairs, right? You can talk about the kind of fullness of socio-cultural opportunities for action. Like, for example, like when you and I walk into a classroom that we're going to teach in, the front of the room is an attractive place to stand. But for the students who walk in, that doesn't seem to afford standing. That's a very complicated affordance, but it's about a relationship between your abilities and social standing and the situation that you're in. And this also allows us to kind of apply the idea of affordance to all kinds of things that had previously really just been parts of discussed in the humanities and social sciences. Things like the differences in affordances for different genders, for people of different races, the relationship between what your body can do, what's afforded, and what you feel invited to do by social pressures. And Taryn A. is connecting this to disability studies, post-colonial studies. I mean, Taryn A. is pushing me very far on this. I'm out of my usual, let's do philosophy of science comfort zone. So again, I think that there are consequences to the different understandings of affordances, even though it sounds like it's just a tempest in a teapot, a small disagreement within the field, I think it actually has bigger ramifications. Or at least I think it now. Again, before Taryn A., Mike Turvey and I used to sit around and talk about how, well, look, if this is just kind of philosophical bookkeeping, we don't disagree on what experiments to do and what we expect the results to be. So it's kind of, we thought at the time that it was kind of like mere philosophy, right? But in fact, Taryn A. Wilkinson has now convinced me that it's actually not mere philosophy and has important consequences.
Yes, absolutely. So the definition that we use for these affordances and how do we make them operational within the context of an application, all these are very important. So if I understand well, two of the main themes of the ecological psychology are, as you said, the relationship between the organism and the environment. And the other one is what Gibson actually meant by ecological information, which is task-specific and differs from Shannon's theory of communication as passing of information through channels at the beginning of first generation of cognitive science, including artificial intelligence. Now, could you please elaborate on this? And in particular, do you believe the ecological information approach is better suited for human-to-human communication? Well, how about the human-AI communication or interaction than is information theory? And in what way?
That's a complicated question. So I guess let me start with going back to the product design and human-machine interaction. Right. So Donald Norman wrote this book in the 1980s, The Psychology of Everyday Things. And I feel like 20 years later, there was a new improved version of it by Paul Dorish, which basically gave us a more genuine understanding of Gibson's ideas of affordances that showed how they're very valuable in talking about product design. Now, again, 20 years after Dorish, Chris Baber has a book called Embodying Design that I think is probably the best, most ecological version of our understanding of how humans interact with technology and how we ought to design technology so that it's better for humans to interact with. So that was like the very beginning of your question, maybe the preamble to your question. What I'm really doing now is just recommending Chris Baber's book. It's free, open access on MIT Press. Okay, so Gibson's theory of information, ecological theory of information, is very different from Shannon information in such a way that it's actually, you know, it's not quantifiable even the way Shannon's information is. The idea is that if we're talking about experience, information has to be meaningful, right? And Shannon's information is essentially a syntactic view that information has to be meaningful. And how information gets its meaning from Gibson's point of view is, you know, it begins with these eight chapters at the beginning of the book that were about philosophy and what the environment is like. So the idea is that it's easy to talk about vision. We are constantly being bombarded by light, either from the sun or from artificial lights. The light reflects off every surface in the room. Anywhere you could put your head, light will arrive, having reflected off all of the surfaces in the room that aren't blocked by something else in your field of view. Now, because of the laws of chemistry and physics and optics, the light will be structured by the things it bounces off of. Right. And that structure, it's available in the light, is the information. So it's not easily quantifiable. The idea is that because of there are all these laws of physics about how things light reflects and how it arrives at locations, those laws make it so that the light, when it arrives at where your eyeball is, carries information about the environment. And most of that information is lawful. Another way in which I disagree with Turvey at all is I think that not all information that arrives at us is lawful. We can talk about that later if you want. So the idea here is Shannon information is syntactic, roughly. Ecological information is semantic or meaningful, right? So we're talking about meaning, not about a logarithmic function of something, right? Of probabilities. We're talking about, meaning. This is a very different way of understanding what information is, and one that hasn't really been built into how we think about and build computers, mm-hmm. Right? So when people who build computers talk about this, they are talking about how do we make it plain on the monitor what the user can do right now, right? So again, the idea is that how do we make there be information about the affordances available to the user, right? And that's one of the main things that Gibson talks about is how the information in the environment isn't just about the nature of the surfaces in the room, it's also about what we can do. So again, a complicated question. Is this a better way to understand human communication? Well, one thing it does is it allows human communication to be rich with meaning, right? So again, it's not a matter of how many bits we're sending down a line or how many bits of information we're providing. It's actually what that information is about, right? So again, I think that's a valuable change that hasn't bled into computer science very much yet, that I think can help us design better ways for humans and machines to interact. I mean, I think too that it's a better story about humans interact with other humans. For example, even though I've been talking for so long and I'm having a hard time remembering all of the question that you asked me, I have no idea how many bits of information or how many words were in it. What was communicated to me was meaning, right? And
right.
Ecological information is a theory of meaning, a meaning that's available in the environment. And again, it's available in the environment in a rich way so that, you know, again, you walk into the classroom, the information is available to you. Where's the right place for the professor to stand? But that's just there in the room. When I tell you about the differing theories of affordances, what I'm doing is I'm trying to pass some meaning on to you in some way or another. I guess here's the way to say it is that in a deep way, Shannon information is a physical theory of information, and Gibson's theory is a theory of information as meaning. Now, I'm sure I missed a few of the points of your question, so please let me know what I didn't talk about.
No, you did answer. You're right, you did remember them and you answered them very well. I strongly agree with that. It seems Shannon's theory of communication really worked well for the computational architecture at the time in the late 50s. And it has been pushed to up to today. So we've been actually using this approach for so long. Shannon's theory really puts a clear upper bound on what we can do. Now, this is actually even more relevant when we consider another concept, which actually is an area of research, and I know that you've been working on this as well for quite some time, which is interpersonal synergies, right? So these are very much connected to the concept of affordances. Could you please tell us what are these and what are the challenges involved here?
Yeah, good. So this starting right around the same time that Turvey and colleagues wrote that big theoretical paper about the nature of affordances and information, they were also working on trying to bring complex systems theory into psychology. And as I said earlier, Gibson says a lot of enigmatic things. One of them is that we have to understand how human behavior or animal behavior is regular, but not regulated. Your behavior is not driven by a pilot, but it is instead self-organizing, right? That's the key term here. And there's a whole science of self-organization starting really in the 1950s. And a synergy is basically the name for a self-organizing system. So self-organizing systems sounds technical and weird, but you know, just go flush your toilet and you see that whirlpool that forms. That whirlpool forms because there's an energy gradient and the energy has to be dissipated. So it turns out that water molecules, when they have this kind of energy gradient in that kind of vessel, engage in statistically very unlikely ways, which is they kind of form a whirlpool, right? And that whirlpool is both made up of the water molecules, but simultaneously kind of shaping or constraining the behavior of the water molecules. So that's what a synergy is. And a synergy, again, these are well studied in physical systems. And starting in the 1980s, people like Turvey, Scott Kelso, Peter Kugler brought these ideas to psychology. And the idea was to understand human action in these kind of self-organizing terms. So a synergy, again, a synergy is a set of things like water molecules that are constrained to behave as a unit for a while. The water molecules are constrained to behave as a whirlpool for a while. In 2011, Mike Riley, Mike Richardson, Kevin Shockley, and Veronica Ramanzoni, I think I have those, the order wrong of that, but published a paper called Interpersonal Synergies. So the idea is that you could apply the same thinking that in the same mathematical tools that you use to understand how the water molecules form a whirlpool, to understand how pairs of humans form a unit to temporarily engage in a task. So an interpersonal synergy is a task-specific grouping of humans, interpersonal, that is constrained to behave as a unit for a while, right? So if you and I were to, and I never go jogging, but if you and I were to go jogging together, we would have to basically adjust, we both like adjust our gait so that we could jog together at a comfortable rate and keep a conversation going. Right. And again, you know, if you're more flexible or have longer legs, you'll want to move differently than I do. So you'll end up kind of altering your behavior in one way, and I'll alter my behavior in another way so that we form a unit, right? That is, that has its own life, as it were. That's an interpersonal synergy. It's, you know, it sounds weird and technical, but it's actually mundane. We see them all the time. You know, whenever two people dance together or have a conversation, they are involved in an interpersonal synergy.
Right, right. So in this interpersonal synergy, we can control our actions. And by controlling, I mean really adjusting to really find that synergy level that you were talking about. But most of the time, we are not aware of the mechanisms that are involved in our regulating our energy and also behavior and speech and so on. How can we study these interpersonal synergies scientifically? In fact, can such rather subjective experiences, because they are subjective, right, be intersubjectively verified? And if so, to what extent?
Okay, so this is going to get a little technical, and I apologize. Audience, I'm sorry, this is going to get a little technical.
We like technical.
Okay. So one of the features of the behavior of any well-functioning living thing is that if you measure its behavior over time, it'll have a fractal structuring, right? Which is to say, changes that happen now have long-term effects on the system's behavior over time. There are lots of names for this. This is sometimes called 1/F scaling or pink noise. And it's basically a property of every well-functioning living thing. It's kind of definitional almost of what it is to be a properly functioning living thing. So for example, if we were to measure the electrical activity of your heart over the course of a day, and it didn't have this property, this 1/F scaling or pink noise, this fractal structuring, you are quite likely to be about to experience cardiac arrest, right? I mean, that's where this was kind of first brought into human physiology, when people noticed that heartbeats of people who were about to die or have a heart attack didn't have this structure. And it's a fractal structure. So one of the things that happens, and this is Bruce West, who works for the Army. He's a physiologist and a mathematician. He proved mathematically, to the extent of my ability to understand the 75 pages of equations that this took, that in order to kind of optimize information flow between systems, the degree of fractality, sometimes called the degree of complexity between the systems, has to match. Okay. So I gave you three names for the same thing, 1/F scaling, fractal structure, pink noise, four names. Now we call it complexity, right? So the kind of natural complexity of your behavior is a part of it being well, a part of you working out okay and being healthy. Now, what's interesting is I can't perceive my own degree of complexity at any moment. I also can't perceive yours while we're having this conversation. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that we're built to perceive. In order to detect it, you have to measure something at least 1,000 times and then do a bunch of hideous mathematics to it and draw plots and look at the slopes of lines. It's not the kind of thing that we just naturally perceive. But what's weird is that when we form interpersonal synergies, we match one another's complexity. So this is work by Rick Dale, Alexandra Paxton, Drew Abney, Chris Kello, and others. They've shown that even though I don't know, you know, what the level of my own complexity of behavior is, or I can't report on the level of your complexity of behavior, when we are having a conversation, those match. And they match in lots and lots of different ways. They match in the patterns of our postural sway as we're having a conversation, which is minimized now because we're both sitting, but they would also match in the intonation, the time between words, the time between sentences, right? So lots of things about our behavior will have this complexity and we'll match them all in order to have a kind of successful interaction. That is an interpersonal synergy. And my favorite bit of research about this is by Alex Paxton and Rick Dale. They showed that when people are having an affiliative conversation, that is the roughly agreeing, they match one another's complexity. But when they are arguing or disagreeing, they don't. Right. So this is this complexity matching, like the fractal structuring is a function of good individual behavior. Complexity matching is a function of good interpersonal interaction, healthy, successful interpersonal interaction. And we manage to match each other's complexity without actually being consciously aware of it. So I can't report on my complexity. I said this already. I can't report on my complexity or yours, but somehow they're matching. And that's an interpersonal synergy. And I mean, you said it was subjective, but it's actually not what we experience, right? When we're engaged in a dialogue, it's what we experience instead is whether we're agreeing or whether she understood that thing I said, or whether, you know, whether my hand movements are distracting, they're distracting me. So, you know, we don't experience like, oh, well, how was she swaying as we conversed? Now, one of the things that's interesting about this is that we all have met people who don't do it, right? Those people that don't adjust their way of moving so that it matches yours while you're having a conversation. And they are very difficult to have a conversation with, right? So this is a skill that we have, this ability to match one another's complexity in social interactions. But it's not a skill. It's an implicit skill. It's not a skill, not a consciously accessible skill.
Right. Yeah. And this is very interesting because, for example, I cannot help thinking of technology. So you mentioned human-to-human communication, right? So two people talking, engaging in a dialogue. But I'm thinking of two people engaging in a dialogue online where their conversation is mediated by an AI-powered interface. The question is, can this interface take advantage of various affordances in the environment and whatever other features and other interests the people involved have to really mediate this and, you know, bring this synergistic dynamics to a particular level? So related to this, because now we already moved to technology, do you believe in the future the AI technology would be able to perceive and take advantage of affordances of interacting with us, for example, or mediating the communication between two people? If yes, to what extent?
So let me start with an idea from, I mentioned Rick Dale and Alexandra Paxton earlier. Also Deborah Tollefson worked on this one. They call it, like, talk about alignment systems. Mm-hmm. And I basically, when I was talking about people having a conversation and how they adjust their sway and their intonation and their word choice and their speech onsets to one another, Those are all separate alignment systems from Deb and Rick and Alex's point of view. Now, we have fewer of them now because we're on Zoom than we would if we were having this conversation in person. So automatically, this kind of interaction is going to be less comfortable, less natural, because we can't align with one another in as many ways as we would if we were like having a beer and chatting about this. Now, bringing this to like how one ought to design things to interface with humans, I mean, I feel like what you want to do is if you want to have a comfortable interaction between a human and an AI, the AI should try to be, should be designed to be matching the complexity of the human, right, in some way or another. Again, in right now, the AIs that we interact with don't sway, but they do, you know, they respond to our questions. And the idea is if they did it in a way that matched the questions in a way that they don't currently, or, you know, this complexity matching, we'd be much more comfortable interacting with them. I mean, I think that, you know, people talk about the uncanny valley, how as AIs get more lifelike, they start to feel less lifelike at a certain point because of the small differences. I actually feel like this complexity matching so that you can form human-machine synergies with an AI, that's maybe what gives rise to this uncanny valley. Because, you know, one of these chat GPT soft things can respond to me in perfectly appropriate English, mostly on topic. But what it doesn't do is match the way that I'm speaking or the way that I'm typing to it. So I think that's a kind of important, an important thing for technology designers to be thinking about in a way that they haven't yet, as far as I know, although so many things are proprietary in this world that I don't know, I don't actually know whether they're thinking about this. But I feel like paying attention to these complexity measures and designing machines that can in real time match them with human interactors is an important step to making us not creeped out by AI.
Right, right. Yes, they have really been thinking about this, but it's not easy. We still have this noisy channel model approach very much ingrained in our scientific practices. Now, AI as a field has been obsessed since its inception in 1950s with this idea of building systems, robots that look and behave like us. Can we build AI that looks and behaves like us without understanding first what life is and what it is to be human? And can ecological psychology help in designing and building such human-like robots?
Good. So I guess what I want to like distinguish between is AI as a technological project versus AI as a cognitive scientific project, right? So what I want to make sure that I never do is underestimate the skills of computer scientists and programmers and what they can accomplish using this kind of technology. So many times people have said, oh, well, computers can do this, yeah, but they'll never be able to do that. And then they're always eventually able to do that too, right? So I think that that's not something you should bet against, right? That is, I shouldn't bet against people being able to design computers based on the same principles as the ones that we're using right now that have, that we can interact with in this kind of natural lifelike way. But those things, so far at least, I would argue, have been utterly useless for the cognitive scientific project, right? Nobody thinks that AlphaGo plays Go the way that we play Go. I play very badly. I always lose to even the dumbest AI Go players. But the, you know, the, but nobody thinks that any of them play the way a competent human does. So yeah, they're really good at it. They are intelligent, but they're not intelligent in a way that enlightens this scientific project of understanding how we work, Right. So I'm not so interested in the technological project, other than that I am sure that people who build these things, especially, my goodness, especially now that you can outsource a lot of your code writing to these chat programs, right? Yeah. What can be accomplished by very smart teams of computer scientists? I don't want to bet on that, but I don't think it's very relevant to how we understand one another as cognitive scientists. Now, I agree with you 100%, or I agree with the tenor of your question 100%, that understanding the cognitive scientific project requires understanding what it is to be a living system, requires understanding how things like us interact with environments like ours, and not just material environments, but sociocultural environments. Now, again, I feel like, and I've been trying to kind of get across, that ecological psychology actually gives us insight into the complicated material and interpersonal and cultural realms in which we navigate. And I think that another view called enactive cognitive science also, which is, a frenemy of the ecological approach. They say very similar things, but are kind of defined against one another. But I think that the enactive approach also, which focuses on what it is to be a living thing, right? I think that that's also something that we need if we're going to make any progress on the cognitive scientific project. That was a really long way of saying, I don't doubt for a second that smart computer scientists like you are going to be able to build machines that knock our socks off. They already have. But I don't necessarily think that those machines, if they ignore what it is to be alive, semantic information, ecological information, culture, I don't think that those are going to help us understand one another. That is, and this is always a problem, right? Because AI and cognitive science started at the same time in the same room, essentially. Right. So I think that if you pull the projects apart, like building really cool machines versus understanding us, I think that's what I've been trying to do in arguing that to do the understanding us project, you probably do need to take into account the difference is between living and non-living things, what it is to have experiences in a real environment, in a rich environment, rich in many, many ways.
Right. Yes, there has been a lot of hype on this in recent years, with especially with these ideas about these large language models, generative AI. But how about for other applications, other projects such as social media, which actually has continued to grow? Can ecological psychology help in designing spaces and facilitate all sorts of practices that support strong social connections online?
So first, let me just brag for a second. I am proudly social media free for the first time in more than a decade.
Can you do that?
I guess I did have to reinstate my Meta account in order to use an Oculus, but I haven't checked it. And I deleted Twitter. But anyway, so one of the things that's going on here, right, is that when we interact in these low bandwidth ways, like, 200 characters on Twitter, we're guaranteed to misunderstand one another, because the kind of richness of interaction, which is diminished here in Zoom, but is much greater than in 220 characters, the richness of interaction just isn't there. And one of the things that ecological psychology has been doing for, ever since it was technologically possible, is working in virtual environments, right? So VR is just kind of built into the methodology of the ecological approach now. I'm starting, 20 years ago, when, the environments were not rich and detailed in the way that they are now, with work by Bill Mace on pursuit and on fly ball catching and things like that in virtual environments. But now up to kind of like, full body avatar social interactions. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is that once we are looking at spaces like that, the kind of richness of environmental information that the ecological approach gives us ways to think about is going to become crucial, right? Because again, if we're having a conversation, if this were in a VR environment, not on Zoom, and you weren't swaying in a way that matched with me, or an AI wasn't swaying in a way that made me comfortable, I would have a hard time interacting with you. Right. So again, the richer the interactions, the more we're going to need these kind of complex systems and ecological and inactive approaches to make sense of how to navigate them. Also, anthropology and sociology, we're going to need them as well. Now, getting back to the low bandwidth social media that we deal with now, I guess what I would suggest is that the ecological approach is a good way to understand why they suck so much. Right? That is why they are so unsatisfying and so limiting to actual human existence and conversation and interaction. I mean, there are some ways in which it's great, right? I used to be able to keep up with friends all over the world very easily, at least, the glimpses of their lives that they want me to see, right? That's great. But, that's a very, very unsatisfying low bandwidth interaction. And as we move to higher bandwidth situations like the metaverse, I think that the ecological approach gets more and more important.
Yes, I believe that too. So Zoom and all these social media platforms, we will not be able to recognize them in 5-10 years. I think that these spaces will be redesigned and rethought to really facilitate better communication online. Now, we are at the end of our interview, unfortunately, because I really enjoyed it. How can people get in touch with you, read about your books and your research projects?
There aren't many people with my last name, Chemero, so it's very easy to Google. I have websites at academia.edu and at the University of Cincinnati where I work. And that's one, just contact me. That's one thing. I have a few books and one that I'm working on interpersonal synergies primarily, in fact.
When is it due?
It's due in December 2020, but I'm not done writing it yet. I am going to finish it this semester. I've promised myself I'm working on the last chapter. So it should come out in the next year.
Great, great. Definitely looking forward to it. I really like your research and really enjoyed the discussion today. Thank you, Tony. Appreciate.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.